Meditation is one of the simplest acts. It is simplicity itself. By focusing the attention in a singular manner, the body, the emotions, the life energy, the ideas floating through our mind all become still. And it is in that stillness that God reveals His presence. Spirit or spiritus means breath. And it is the breath that connects the body with the spirit. It is with breath when the child comes out of the womb that it first awakens to this outer world. It is when we draw our last breath and exhale it out that the soul leaves this body. By focusing the attention on that most natural act of breathing, bringing the attention to that most single act, going in and out. The body at first rebels, the emotions rebel, the life energy wants to activate, thoughts run rampant, all because, like an undisciplined dog, it wants to run everywhere, but it can be brought to heel, it can be disciplined by focusing the attention. And when it is disciplined in the proper way, it allows it to become still. So just observing the breath. Bringing your full attention upon the origin of breath. That is, that point of origin of the nose right between the eyebrows. And there, as you breathe in, simply mentally repeating the word Hong, as in Hong Kong. As you naturally breathe out, without trying to control the breath at all, you mentally chant the word Sa, as in hammer and saw, only it's spelled S-A-U. These are two Sanskrit words that are meant to harmonize with this high state of consciousness. And it means, I am spirit. I am He. And then to enter into the stillness of your being is to come into the inner temple of silence, and there worship the one God. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Thou shalt love the Lord with all thy heart, all thy strength, with all thy soul. And the second one like unto it, thy neighbor as thyself ye shall love. Upon this hang all the laws and all the prophets. Bringing your full attention and awareness to that inner stillness reveals that omniscient light of which we are all a part, but we have fallen asleep to. Master used to say, breathlessness is deathlessness. Because within that breathless state, when the breath becomes still, all is revealed. And when all is revealed, you realize that you are a deathless spirit. And St. Paul once wrote that he died daily and he rejoiced in that. That is, he brought that breath to a still state and there felt the bliss of his oneness with Christ. This may be a part of each and every one of our natures. So striving ever forward into that stillness, to have that light revealed within us, let us pray from that inmost consciousness. O Heavenly Father, Divine Mother, beloved Jesus Christ, Blessed Master, dearest Mother, Saints and sages of all religions,
I bow to all of you.
Free my life from all obstacles. And give me physical, mental, and spiritual development. Make my mind thy temple.
Make my heart thy altar.
Make my love thy home. Be thou the only King. Reigning on a throne of my consciousness. Peace. Bliss. Amen. It's a little warm out tonight, and just brings to my mind a way that you can inwardly cool yourself, and that is above your head, imagine a cool blue light. And if you can, feel that coolness descending and coming down over your whole body. You can either use your fingers for alternate breathing or just by closing the alternate nasal passage. You can breathe in through your left nostril. And when you breathe out, focus the attention on the right nostril. Breathing in through the left nostril. And breathing out through the right nostril. And imagining that cool light, like blue ice on top of your head, cooling your whole body. Now, if you ever want to warm yourself because it's cold, you can imagine a fire burning in the very center of your being, just like a furnace fed by gas. And when you feel that, feel the warmth coming out through your limbs and your fingers and out through your whole body. And breathe in through your right nose and out through your left nose. The yogis, when they practice such things, are able to endure great cold and stay in comfortable temperatures. So it comes in very handy. I'd like to read from Yogananda, a piece entitled Cosmic Consciousness. I sat on the mound with eyes closed, watching the inky darkness that enveloped me. There was not within me but darkness, but I seemed to seek something unknown, yet familiar. I opened my eyes, and the gay world of splendor richly decorated with measureless sheet of twinkling moonbeams, sublime stars teeming with mysteries unspoken, myriads of flowers, green velvet grass, chains of shining peaks, light bejeweled waves of heaving seas, mighty power of cities, these mocked at me and called me a dreamer. The voice of the proud world seemed to laugh and say, "Foolish dreamer, why shut your eyes and banish my beauty from your sight and live in empty darkness?" I silently said within myself, "Audacious intruder, thy beauty would forever remain unappreciated without the invisible inmates of my dark mental chamber." Even as I thought this, I felt the thrilling call of some mysterious charm within. I closed the doors of my eyes. There again I was confronted with the same abysmal darkness. I watched with steady vision, looking and seeking in all directions, sometimes bewildered. I felt I caught glimpses of opaque thought, which became half visible in that deep mystic chamber. I steadily watched in the dim but growing light of my concentration. The gloom became softer and revealed its hidden glory. I found I could see there without my eyes, seeing each glimmering thought like dream lightning flash and disappear, or come bursting like star shells with revealing showers of light and vanish in the mental sky. I could count each flash, each outburst, recognize their intensity, their duration, and meaningful splendors. I found I could hear there, without my ears, the muffled, chafing roars of loud, powerful thoughts, softer, sweet suggestions of conscience, and the quiet voice of reason. I heard distinctly all they said, as I had never heard before. Thus, for the first time, I felt the presence of these living, inner, invisible blood relations, their warmth and their indifference towards me. These, my own, long had lived so near this dark chamber, planning, organizing, molding my destiny, yet unassuming, unnoticed, unseen, unheeded. What charm you cast around! What stupendous work you do, invisible friends! Are you afraid to plainly appear in the crude, scorching gaze of human minds? Do you fear to be hurt by the twilight of pale, unthinking mentalities, or choked by the gross vibration of noisy matter? Yet how stealthily you go out of the dark chamber to build the huge skyscrapers, the mighty bridges, and all material achievements, then slip away unknown, unthanked, unhonored, unsought. The coursing train in the nightly gloom, the whirling airplane, the floating steel village with small cabins, the triumphs of art, the Parthenon and Taj Mahal, all man-made miracles, all remind me of you only and your powers, O mighty thoughts. But when I see the sparkling lake welcoming me to quench my thirst, and the dark clouds bursting with eagerness to pour its rivers of rain, to fill our life-giving paddy fields, and nectar fruit trees, and moon's light switched on at the approach of darkness, and the changing round of the seasons, and the hall of the world beautifully carpeted with soft green grass, and the sunlight-painted clouds on the canvas of the sky, all these matchless scenic pictures, I begin to question, whose is the cosmic hand that works so wisely, powerfully, everywhere? I wonder whose all-pervading voice commands the sun, moon, planets, earth, nature, the seasons, all blind forces, the ebbing and flowing seas, man, life and death, and receives their obedience. Is there an infinite chamber of mystery in which one limitless, luminous mind hides and secretly reaches forth to decorate the universe with endless charms? Down through the windows of memory I looked. I recall the early hour of my childhood when the sun of my consciousness first began gradually to appear. As it slowly rose out of the darkness of the unconscious mind, it dimly lighted only one part of my little mental horizon that lay encompassing my mother. Playthings and a few multicolored candies. Later, as my consciousness grew brighter, I found a great part of my mental horizon became illumined. I saw it in many other things, my friends, relations, neighbors, my country. These were revealed and included. Now, as I look within on the mental sky, the sun of my consciousness seems to be shining brighter than ever. In its supreme power, it no longer lights one direction, or only a portion of my mental horizon, or only a few friends or one nation, but all nations, nay, all creatures and nature, all planets, all stars, all shining electrons, all universes, all space. I did not know that out of the inky darkness of my mind, I would discover the sun of cosmic consciousness. I'd like to speak this evening on reincarnation. Is it true? It is said in Eastern philosophy that we are all on a spiritual journey of incredible magnitude. When we first come and experience material creation, we come with sheaths, as if, as one way of speaking of it, these sheaths that are surrounding us, five different sheaths. And as we look through these filters of these sheaths, we experience the world of the minerals and of the earth. And that is the limit of our consciousness. That's the limit of our life within that consciousness. As we grow accustomed to this and eventually outgrow this, that outer sheath falls away. And when we come into the next realm, we experience the world of vegetation. All plant life becomes ours to experience. And the soul resides within those plants as living consciousness. As we move from one generation to the next, gradually increasing consciousness, gradually increasing our ability to experience the light and the intelligence of consciousness, that sheath falls away. This reveals the nature of the animal. And we have many incarnations as a variety of animals with increasing complexity, nervous systems, ability to have intelligent thought and perception. And as we outgrow that sheath, it too falls away, revealing human experience. Now, within human experience is a more complex nervous system with greater ability to perceive the light of consciousness. A new aspect emerges, that of the intellect, the ability to be self-aware, the ability to project into the future, to image within the mind things that are not strictly of this world. And with these capacities, we grow in consciousness. We become more self-aware. Our sense of individual will becomes more developed, and we can make choices. No longer are we in the instinct of an animal, or in the blind instinct of a plant, or in the negligible will of the mineral. But rather, we can make choices, and we come into the knowledge of good and evil. And through that knowledge, we make choices that either benefit us in our evolution, which is no longer guided but through blind forces, but rather through the intellect. As the intellect is gradually awakened, we come to know that we are made up of something greater than just this physical stuff of which the body is made up of. We are made up of so many minerals. We have this growth that occurs within the cells, even as plants do. We have the ability for movement and to be able to perceive through the senses, even as animals do. And beyond that, we are able to have this intelligent thought of the intellect. And through the light that is given to us by illumined masters, we set out on a spiritual path in order to drop the final sheath, that of the human, and to emerge into the divine. Jesus spoke of himself in two different veins. One was as the Son of Man, and the other was as the Son of God. The Son of Man are those things that are human, those things that are of the body, of the world, those things that live in separation from the oneness of God. And in the story of the scriptures, the Son of Man must die. For what purpose? In order for there to be a resurrection into the Son of God, that it might be fully manifest. And so, at that final moment within the story, it is the giving up of the ghost, which is this human ego. And it is returning with the power of the Holy Ghost, or of the divine self, the divine ego. This is the story of every man in its movement from the human to the divine, in the final dropping off of this sheath. It is the story of all evolution and is the ultimate consummation of conscious evolution that started so very long ago. One of the great spiritual masters in the 20th century, Meher Baba, said, by the time you get to a human birth, you are 90% of the way there to realization. That's very encouraging, because we have come from such a long, long way. Mother said that one time when she was in deep meditation, she saw there her first incarnation, and it was as a dewdrop hanging off of a leaf. Now, is reincarnation something that is real, or is it something that is imagined? When we come into this life as a small baby, we have tremendous capacity. We have tremendous memory. Yogananda spoke in the beginning of the autobiography of a yogi that when he was first born, he had all these different languages coming through his mind, that he had all these different memories of different lifetimes. But as we grow accustomed to being in this body, we begin to attune our ear to the language that is spoken around us. We have to do that in order to become acclimated to the culture, to the language, to the habits of the family that we are growing up in. And if it were not for that, we would be able to retain that former consciousness. But because we get so involved in learning about this body and about this world and about this language, all those other things fade into the background, all those other memories, all those other awarenesses. There's a very interesting study done at the University of Washington, done with Japanese nationals, that is, children who are born in Japan. And they were compared to children that of Japanese origin that are born and raised here in America. And from the early years, before they learn language, they're exposed to these language differences of being able to identify the difference between L's and R's. And when they are of pre-language age, the babies are able to easily distinguish between the letter L and the letter R. By the time the Japanese children that grow up in Japan and learn Japanese language come into their own language, they are no longer able to distinguish between those two sounds. The Japanese children that are brought up into America and learn the English language as their first language easily continue to recognize the difference between L's and R's. The idea being that we are born with all this mental capacity, but determined by our culture, determined by our language, determined by those things which are encouraged versus those things which are ignored or discouraged. Certain parts of our brain remain activated and other parts fall into atrophy. Our ability to recognize spirit, our ability to recognize psychic phenomena, oftentimes fall into these categories. They are just simply dropped away because they are not encouraged. They are not spoken of. They are not utilized. And therefore, they just simply atrophy in the mind. They are no longer activated. And through that lack of activation, we simply forget that they are there. Now, this goes for all the capacity of our brain. It is said by scientists that we use between 5 and 10% of our brain. What is the rest of our brain for? And at least in part, what we are living unaware of is this ability to rise up into cosmic consciousness. That is the Son of God that is within us and is an innate capacity. It is our inheritance that we bring with us as human beings. Now, as we make effort to grow spiritually and become calm within, to become quiet within, and focus our attention here at this center, if thine eye be single, thy whole body shall be filled with light. Now, this is the attention becomes single here, and the light that is revealed is this light of spirit that resides within you. In the pictures of the saints is this nimbus or this halo that resides around the head. This is an actual experience for realized beings who rise up in consciousness, and this purity of spirit in gold begins to envelop the whole being. When I was in India, I had the privilege there to have the darshan of Satya Sai Baba. And he is a spiritual master in India. When I saw him walk out, he has a large afro kind of hairdo that he's had for many years, since the 1930s. But around that was this glow of life energy that flowed all around the top of his head. Now, those who have their inner vision awakened see this easily within others. They see the aura. They see these colors. They see this life energy that is flowing all around us at all times. But most of us are unaware of it. You can experiment with that. If somebody were to stand across the room from you, and you stand up straight, and you're facing them, and they walk closer to you. And as they get within a certain distance of you, suddenly you feel them come into your energy field. You feel their presence in your presence. And it's something that is tangential to the mind. It's visceral. You can feel it. If you have somebody put their hand close to your hand and move it back and forth, you can feel the movement of energy between their hand and your hand. You can do it to your own hand. And you can feel that energy, that life energy that extends out from this body, that surrounds this body. Now, this is totally natural. There's nothing supernatural in that way about it. It's very natural that this body exudes that. In Krillian photography, they show these energy patterns that come around animate, what we call animate objects, as well as inanimate objects. I had a professor once in anthropology, and he invited this man from Australia to come. He had lived with the Aborigines there. He had taken initiation with them, and as proof of that, he had two fingers cut off. That was part of their initiation rites. So it was no small task for him to go through this. They had given him this rock that they said was very powerful. Well, years later, he had been lost out in the outback there, and he finally found his way back, and he had brought this rock back with him. He'd forgotten about it, put it up on an upper shelf. He had an Aboriginal woman come in to clean his house for him. And as soon as she entered in through the door, she said, "I feel something very powerful here." And she walked over to this closet, and she opened this closet, and up on the very top shelf, behind some other things, was this rock, and she went straight to it. And she said, "Where did you get this?" And so he told her the story, and she recognized it. She felt the vibration of this rock. Now, we look at rocks, and we think, well, maybe there's nothing extraordinary about that. But every once in a while, you get into a situation where you feel the power of a certain place. Perhaps it's of a mountain. Perhaps you're walking along in the woods, and suddenly you feel the change. It's almost as if there's an atmospheric change and you feel the vibration of that place. And as you walk through that, you feel this change come over you and you know that you've moved into something extraordinary. Perhaps you come near something that we might call its animate, a large old tree, for instance, and you feel a certain vibration about that. That is the soul of that tree or of that rock. And these are all souls that are in the act of becoming. They're existing within those sheaths of covering. And as they gradually unfold, they too will gradually come into greater light, into greater awareness. And through that, they too will go through this long journey of unfoldment, of consciousness, until they too one day become a son of God. Jesus said something very interesting one time. He said that God could raise out of these rocks children of Abraham. Well, he wasn't just speaking metaphorically. It actually happens in that way. Now, it happens in a much longer time period than what we normally think of. But this is part of our evolutionary course. If we would but know it. How do we know it? How do we come to know it? He also said, when his disciples were all singing Hosanna, "Tell these ones to be quiet, and the stones themselves will sing out this." Because they too have spiritual vibration. Now they can't know it in the same conscious way because it's spontaneous in them. And they haven't come into this full conscious awareness of it yet. But it's natural for stones to sing this out. And sometimes that's why you find these stones, these rocks, that contain very great and wonderful souls within them, in the becoming. And you feel the presence in it. And sometimes it comes across in a negative way. And sometimes it's because of the nature of those stones, of those trees, of those animals, of those people, or sometimes it's because something that's been invested in them from something outside of them. When you go to these places of pilgrimage, Why are they powerful? Sometimes saints are drawn to places because they are already spiritually charged. They feel it when they walk into it. Other times, they charge those places. Or it's a combination. They felt drawn to it because it's charged, and then they go into it and they charge it even more. Sometimes they're drawn to places, like St. Anthony was, where there's a very negative charge was, and he had to go down into these catacombs in Egypt, where these souls had been killed in the most tragic way, and he fought these fierce kind of demons. They even beat him up to where he came out in an unconscious state. And so sometimes we get into situations like that, and we're struggling with these forces that are beyond the physical. But remember this, light is always stronger than darkness. Though a room may be dark for 1,000 years, open a window, open a door, and the light comes in and destroys the darkness that seemed to dominate that place for 1,000 years. Any time that you move into a place of darkness, affirm the light within yourself. Affirm the power and the dominance of light within you beyond any power of darkness, and you will break it. One of the greatest affirmations that we have, God, Christ, Gurus. And it's a wonderful affirmation. It's a wonderful affirmation, and will break any darkness that we might be involved with. And so this evolutionary course begins to expand our own consciousness. We gradually drop off the sheath of this humanness. And what's revealed is our whole history. It said that when the Buddha came into his full realization, the Buddha means the enlightened one. It's the same meaning as the Christ, the anointed one. These were not names that were given to people. These are titles. These are descriptive titles of what these individuals have achieved. And it's really something. It's great. But when Buddha went through this final realization and became awakened, he was awakened to all of his previous births. Now, we don't have to go searching after memory of previous births. This can become a sidetrack. And there are even potentially some dangerous aspects if we get involved in a lifetime that was very, very difficult, and it may come to preoccupy our mind. See, there's a very great grace in not remembering our past lifetimes because we're not constantly comparing ourselves. It's as if we're given a fresh slate and we can say, all right, we can create this life as we will. Now, there's one caveat to that, and that is this idea of samskaras, or those tendencies that we bring from past lives. Why is it that some children are born and they have a very distinct personality pattern with very distinct habits? Where did they get this from? Sometimes the children or the parents look at each other and they say, where did this child come from? We don't even know. It doesn't even resemble us in any way in terms of its thought and its habit patterns. I'm sure my parents have looked at me a time or two like that. But it is because we come with this tendency that is prenatal. That is, it comes with us from the point of conception, and it stays with us. Sometimes we wonder in our own life, why do I have this fear of heights? Or why do I have this fear of drowning? Or of dark places, or all kinds of things that come to us. I've never drowned in this lifetime. I don't recall ever being afraid in a dark place. And so we can't connect it to anything in this lifetime. And it's because it connects us to a further back time. A time that is part of our continuous consciousness, except that it's not part of our conscious memory in this time. And so these are indications of things that we bring with us. It's also true of positive attributes. Why do I seem to be naturally good at music or mathematics or art. I just seem to have a knack for it. Other people seem to struggle with it, and it just comes naturally to me. Why is that true? Is God uneven in the way that he hands out talents or intelligence? How is it that these geniuses are born? The one definition for genius is unlearned knowledge. Well, how in the world do you explain that? Unlearned knowledge. It seems to come natural. It's spontaneous. It's as if they've always had that. And the only way to explain that is through the history of reincarnation. Now, as we grow stiller, more still within, and these inner revelations open, we don't have to search out after previous incarnations, but sometimes they come to us. And when they come to us like that, spontaneously, through our own internal spiritual search, it is there to help release us from something we're struggling with oftentimes, or it helps to show us why we are who we are. I was struggling with an issue one time. Every once in a while, I would just get cold, just down to my bones. Usually I was a little bit impervious to cold, but every once in a while I'd just get chilled right to my bones, and it happened just like that, and I'd want to throw up. And it just take me over, and it would last for a few minutes, maybe 5 minutes or 7 minutes, and then it would start to pass away. And it was the strangest thing, and it was just like I was shaking from the inside out, and so cold. And then it was shown to me how, at one time, I was in this condition where I was just this cold. I was just a young boy, and it was just so extremely cold. And every once in a while, for some reason, that memory was released in me. Something triggered it, and it just brought the physical conditions back from that. Through my lifetime, sometimes having cravings for food was there. And this other memory came back, where I had been in severe Russian winters, and I was a large, bulky man who worked very easily out in this extremely cold weather. And part of it was like I was a big, big polar bear. And I just had these layers of fat around me, but it was hardened fat. I worked very hard, but there was this idea that that was part of my protection. And it was very much sewn into the idea of who I was. And so there was this part of my mind that kept acting on this idea that I should have this padding, that I should have this bulk, even though it wasn't required in this lifetime. And so sometimes within a flash, a whole lifetime will come to you. And you'll know certain details about it. Maybe you'll know a lot of details, maybe just certain details, because that's all that you need. You know, sometimes revelation comes like this. You're sitting in a dark room, completely pitch black. You have your eyes open. Suddenly somebody switches the light on for a few seconds and then flips it back off. As soon as the lights go off, you can picture everything. You can picture the piano, the bookcases, the chairs, everything that's in the room, just from those couple seconds of light. And sometimes revelation comes like that. It just unfolds within the mind in a spontaneous way. And you know certain facts. You know, you understand certain aspects of that incarnation. And the reason that you know that it has a value is because it fits something about your life in this lifetime. And through that revelation, it begins to slowly unravel certain psychological kinks that you have. These knots begin to loosen themselves up. It doesn't necessarily happen all at once, but gradually the understanding comes. And then you can begin to release yourself from those old thought patterns, from those old habits. And you can move further in your own evolution from the human to the divine. You see, as we move forward, the thing that we come up against those obstacles. They will come, by definition, because we live in a limited human consciousness. And as we try to grow spiritually, certain fears will come, certain desire natures will come, certain habit patterns will come, and we see them as obstacles. And from the standpoint of looking at it from evolving from the human to the divine, they are obstacles, but they don't come purely by chance. Or it's not God just testing us in the sense of, oh, that one needs a good little test. We are facing ourselves and all the things that we've done as we've moved out from the human and come to the human, rather, and we've come through all these successive layers of consciousness, and all those things that we have put out through all this time, we come to face all those things. It's like you're taking a journey, and you travel so far down the road, but there's only one road, and so when you say, well, it's time to go home, I've gone so far out, then I turn the vehicle around, or I turn this body back around, and I start going back down the road or the path exactly the way that I came. And all those things that I had created on the outward journey, I face as I come back. So really, as we face these obstacles, as we face these things on our way back, we're only facing ourselves. So if we want to blame somebody, if we want to be angry with somebody, if we want to thank somebody, we just look in the mirror. And that's the person who created it. And so we just, you know, it's a little bit like the person who takes a credit card and goes out and runs up a great big high credit bill. And then they think, oh my God, what have I done? I have all this credit, and what do I have to show for it? You know, these things that seem like such a good deal at the time no longer seem like such a good deal. Plus, we have all the interest built up. And so we just have to sit down with ourselves and give ourselves a good talk and say, all right, I'm not charging anything more, and I'm paying it off. And it takes time. It takes time, but as we pay a few things off, it begins to pick up speed because we have more capital as we pay a few things off to pay off more and more of the other things. And if we stay true to it and don't run up any more debt and are busy paying off the old debt, suddenly it takes on a greater and a greater life, and that debt begins to dwindle, begins to disappear. And one day we look at the bank account and we find that we're debt free. We're debt free, and what a wonderful time that is. What a wonderful time that is. But in that paying off of the debt, there's only one person we have to look at for the cause of it. It's ourselves. And in the same way with this karma, as you sow, so shall you reap. And you shall not escape until every aspect of the law is fulfilled. And that includes the law of karma. So, we must pay it off. And if we do it with determination, if we do it with intentionality, and stop running up debt and start paying off, it may seem like a very long time while we're doing it. But gradually, gradually, comes down, comes down, comes down. And then one day we're debt free. And then we can live spontaneously by the spiritual consciousness and current that comes through us, and we leave behind all these other lifetimes. You see, you are the culmination of everything you have ever been. But also, you are that perfection of God that started out as original innocence within you. And this is the Savior consciousness within you. To all them who received Him, gave He power to become the sons of God. That is you. Right now you may be living in the Son of Man consciousness, that is, only conscious and aware of this body and your role in this world. But secretly, deeply residing within you is this Son of God. And if with determination and true intention we set our feet on that path, we will discover who and what we truly are. but we must persevere. We must strive. We must learn to refocus our attention upon God, always bringing it back to God, always bringing it back to God. The attention wanders, bring it back to God. It wanders away again, bring it back to God. I was surprised to read one time where airplanes, when they're put on automatic pilots, 90% of the time they're off course. The function of the automatic pilot is to bring it back on course. So the moment we discover we're off course, bring ourselves back to course. The mind wanders away, bring it back to God. Always, always, always. And if we do that, that's paying off our debt. And we will come into our oneness with that. And we will know that all these successive incarnations have culminated finally in our true freedom, in the heavenly kingdom of consciousness within us. C.S. Lewis once wrote that when you come into heaven, you then see all your previous experiences in a positive light because it's all brought you to this point. But when you enter into hell, you look back and you see all your previous experiences as being terrible and negative and dark. And we don't have to look far to see that. Whenever we've been in a depressed state, we just have to look at our back. Oh, everything's terrible. Everything I've done is wrong. Nothing's ever gone right for me. The good things happen for other people, but not for me. True? But when we feel good about our lives, when we feel positive, when things are going our way, we look back on our life and we go, thank God for those experiences. Thank God I went through those things because they brought me to where I am now. And that becomes our awareness. That becomes our interpretation of events. So this is our path. Your life is your spiritual sadhana. Your home, your heart is your ashram. Who you are today, the activities that you have, you can judge them if they're good activities, if they're wholesome. That is your spiritual path. That is your sadhana. You don't need to go to a cave someplace. Your life is your spiritual life. Your life is your sadhana. It exists right where you're at. You don't have to go anywhere else. Let me just stop there and see if there's any questions about anything I've spoken about or anything about your own spiritual sadhana, your spiritual path to God.
David, sometimes I'm wondering when you say bring, when you're thinking of something and then bring it back to God.
Yes.
What does that mean exactly?
Well, it can be the various practices that we have. It can be bringing it back to Hansa there at the point of the ajna. And bringing it back and just, let's say you're in a work situation and suddenly you're caught up. Somebody maybe has given you some criticism, or you're criticizing yourself, or you're feeling a lot of tension, all the pressure to get something done, and you're under some time restraint. And you've completely forgotten the divine. You're totally absorbed in all these worldly activities. And suddenly you're aware that your breathing is very shallow. Your shoulders are sore because they just feel like you have 1,000 pounds on them. You think, oh my goodness, look what I'm doing to myself. Just stop this. It's the nature of my thoughts that I'm feeling the burden of all of this. And you just take a few moments and you just go inside and you do Hong Sa. You feel your body begin to relax. You bring your attention here. You feel a little bit of stillness. Your body is still vibrating with all that rajasic active energy. But you just stick with it. And you come into a greater sense of stillness. And when that stillness is with you, and you kind of, you get more fully established in that stillness, Then you start working again, but this time you carry that feeling of stillness with you. That feeling of relaxation, that deeper breathing, that Hong Sa. And you let go of all those things that you can't control. And you just keep your mind centered right there. And you just do one thing at a time. All right, here's the next thing. Now the next thing. Now the next thing. I just do what I can do. All the while breathing and focusing on Hong Sa. That's an example of bringing the mind back to God. If you're doing some service for someone, and suddenly you get caught up in their personality, and you get very irritated with them, and why am I doing this for them, and they don't even appreciate it, and they just demand it of me, and suddenly you're just caught up in this anger with them. And you realize, I'm really angry. My anger is just huge. But, you know, this is a small situation. Let me just let that go. All those judgments about what are they thinking? Are they appreciating it? Are they acknowledging it? All that kind of stuff, I let it all go. I go, you know, my life is about service. And it's not about them and what their attitude is and what they appreciate or don't appreciate. Do I feel like this is the right thing for me to be, is to be in service to them right now? Answer comes back, yes, this is the right thing. All right, let me shift my attitude. I'm going to be very simple about this. This is about my expression of God. This is a gift, freely given, without any strings of attachment that they should be appreciative or that they should have a certain attitude or anything like that. I'm just going to serve them. And I'm going to, like Mother Teresa, I'm going to see the Christ in them. Or I'm going to see God in them. Or I'm going to attune myself to the feeling of flow of God within me, of love, in spite of the fact, or maybe because, they're being a bit ornery. Or they're not having appreciation or all that. And so much more so that they need this light in their life. So I shift my perspective and how I serve them then. So it's stopping yourself in the midst of attachment to outcomes, to how we think things ought to be, or afraid of coming up short and that criticism that we give to ourselves, we're afraid somebody else, and we stop that, and then we get focused on becoming much more simple and serving and loving and doing from that perspective. And what that does is it just, one is it relaxes our whole body. We get access to a fresh, new flow of life force, where before we are tight. We're burning all that life force up in our body, and we are becoming more and more constricted. We become more relaxed, and we feel like we're in the flow of that life energy. And that is karma yoga. Karma means action, and yoga means union. So it's union with the divine flowing through our action. An example is that one person can be walking, and you can see it in their posture and everything. It looks like they're pushing against the air. They're fighting against gravity. I mean, they just can't get there fast enough. And then you see somebody else moving, and they're almost as if they're being carried. They're being moved through. You feel the life energy. And when we compare that with ourselves and we're walking down the street, we can feel that we just can't get there fast enough and we're pushing against everything all the time. Or we can get centered inside and we can feel as if it's the divine life that's flowing through us and carrying us to our destination and where we're going. Very different way of getting there. And the ego is afraid, well, if I don't get there quick enough, if I don't do it like this, and if I don't like do it like that, everything will come apart. And it's because the ego sees itself as the doer. So it's letting go of the idea that we're the doer. It doesn't mean that we become without action. And it doesn't mean that we become ineffective. In fact, what we find out is we usually become more effective. But we see God as the doer and we are the witness. And our part is to pay very strict attention to God and our connection with God. That's our part. And then the other part is to feel that flow through us and manifest through us. And that changes everything. And it makes life joyful. It makes it blissful. Doesn't mean that the body sometimes doesn't get tired out. Doesn't mean sometimes we don't expend everything that this body has to give. But there's a peace in there. There's a joy in there. And when we work that way, we're much more likely to win cooperation of other people. And then, why didn't you get it done already? You know, what, can't you see? I need this right now. Is there something I can do to help you do your job so that we can get this done together quickly? It allows you to join with people. Doesn't mean you become purposeless. It's sometimes difficult to talk about because our minds are so wedded to this rajasic energy. That is that always activating, always going, 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 going. And when we hear about this sattvic energy, we don't have full experience of it. That is the sweetness, that's the fullness of spirit that moves through us. And so from a rajasic standpoint, what we connect to is the tamasic, and that is the inertia. That is getting stuck. That's having no energy, no motivation. And so we automatically begin to relate it to the tamasic instead of seeing how sattvic or that spiritual current and consciousness can move through us and be an uplifting force. We just don't have enough experience with it. So the ego says, boy, if I let go of this, I'm going to come to a dead stop. And so it's afraid of that happening. So it's teaching ourselves about this sattvic energy, this smooth flow of uplifting consciousness. And when we work that way, there's no comparison. No comparison to the old way of being in the world. It's quite wonderful. And that is karma yoga. That answer your question? Yeah. There's a lot of aspects to it. There's a lot of dimensions to it, but those are a few. That's fine. Om Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram. You know, it's what inspires us. It's what gives us faith. Papa used to tell this story because he recommended Om Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram. He'd initiate people into other mantras if they were felt more drawn to something else. But he says, really, anything that inspires us and gives us perfect faith. Tells the story of the devotee who didn't feel worthy at all of getting spiritual teachings, but so desired it in their heart. And they thought, oh, I'm such an ordinary person, and I just don't think that I can get initiation, but I want realization so badly. So one time there is a guru, and he's teaching in the outskirts of town, and he had people gathered around him, and this man got a little bit closer, and he kind of hid behind the trees and the bushes, and he wanted to get a little bit of the teachings, and he just got so close and come drifting into his hearing came the word pestle, like mortar and pestle. And he thought, oh, the guru has initiated me into this mantra, pestle, 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 pestle. He just took that in complete faith, and it said that his faith grew so perfect that through his perfect faith, his mind was purified, and a golden pestle from heaven came down and swooped him up into heaven. So, in the one hand, around this idea of mantras and this idea of chanting, there is power in these different words. One is that the yogis attune themselves that words have vibration, and depending on the vibration, it either has an uplifting aspect or it has a degrading aspect to it. And that these yogis became very fine-tuned and recognized the difference in words and vibration. All of Sanskrit is based on this, that the correct pronunciation of these words are very, very important because they carry a certain vibration with it. And when spoken correctly, it has this transformational aspect to it. So through these mantras, there is this vibration that has been attuned to different levels of consciousness. Also, there's the aspect that, as Master talks about with different chants that he wrote or that he brought from India and introduced here to America, that he sang them until he got a divine response, that is, until he was lifted up into divine consciousness. And he divinized the songs through this. Well, some of these songs in Om Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram have been sung for millennia in India by different realized beings. And with each one of them singing them and bringing themselves into this high, high state of consciousness, it takes on a greater and a greater spiritual power. So between these two aspects, that it's attuned to a certain frequency on a vibrational level, and also that it's been spiritualized through these great masters using these mantras and these chants, then they come already imbued with a great power. But truly, it is what inspires us. It's what gives us great faith. And faith is the most important ingredient in all of this. And when we take something in complete faith, you know, in the way of the pilgrim, it was, Lord Jesus Christ, have mercy on me. He just repeated that over and over and over again and was lifted up into the joy and the bliss of Christ consciousness. And so from that standpoint, it is whatever gives us total and complete faith. And to take that and to take it all the way to God will give us perfect realization. It's very comforting when we come to know that our life has purpose. There was a psychologist, Viktor Frankl, who wrote In Search of Meaning. And his contention as a psychologist was that the most important element in our life is to find meaning in our life. And that for those people who find no meaning leads to depression, despair, hopelessness. And I'm come back, it seems like a very simple thing, but a very profound teaching that Papa gave to me when I was in India. And I was very sick, perhaps with typhoid. My tongue was completely jet black and running a very, very high fever and terrific pain in the body. And I was chanting and keeping my mind on God, and I would see Papa above this body, and I would go up and I would join him, and we would just start dancing around in circles, singing Om Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram, and I just feel this great joy And even with all the pain, with all the fever, with everything that was going on in me, there is also the joy there. And I remember looking down on this body with him, and for some reason a very strange thought came into my mind. I says, you know, Papa, if we just put more pressure in that part of the head, we could make that body cry. Talking about this body. And Papa said, no, only that which is necessary is applied. And so to know, you know, how many times that we've been in pain or difficulty or illness, and if we could absolutely know in that moment that only that which is necessary is applied. We feel so alone in our pain. We feel the unequal aspect of it. Why can't I have a normal existence how I see other people having existence? Why can't I be free of this pain or this illness? Or why did I have all these monies and suddenly it's gone into all these paying off doctors and hospitals and all of that? It seems so unfair. And if we could know the meaning, at least have faith in the idea that there is meaning behind this, would be such a great comfort to us, that so much of our distress in illness is fear and resentment and these negative emotions that build up in us because we don't understand that there is meaning in it and that it's being measured out in a very exact way. It's not arbitrary. It doesn't just come out of the blue. It just isn't due to our genetics or good luck or bad luck or any of that kind of thing. But it's following a very specific law and pattern. And so much of what we experience really is determined by our meaning that we assign to it as to whether it has an elevating effect or a degrading effect. And so oftentimes we love to go and see movies where somebody is going through a really difficult time and somehow they come through it and they come out on top of it and we all cheer. Because that's us, ultimately. We see ourselves in that. And that's what we want for ourselves. We want to take the higher road. But it doesn't mean that it's easy. And sometimes it all catches up with us, and we just feel overwhelmed with it. And that is where our understanding and our faith in a divine origin, and that we're held in that divinity, no matter what comes. Krishna tells Arjuna in the Gita, he says, try your very best. Keep your mind on me. Do what you will. There's one of two outcomes here. Either you die, and if you die with that kind of attitude, you go directly to heaven. Or you succeed, and you have an opportunity to bring this light onto earth. Either way, you win. And if we can hold that in complete and total faith, and it's not easy. These are difficult things. But some people seem to be able to do it, and others don't. And some vacillate, and they show great strength, and other times it just seems to overwhelm them. And from a human standpoint, very understandably so. But if we could have that absolute faith, there's that light to hang on to. What meaning there is for us in that then? What comfort? What security? That we can be free of fear. Yes. And one thing we can do is we can, through the power of our own thought, we can have that prayer for them, that that comforting light is shining in them. And that we can see them being supported by that light, comforted by that light, enlightened by that light, that they can know that what they are going through is not without meaning and not without purpose. And to find the comfort in that. And perhaps even joy. Now, it's next to cruelty to come up to somebody who's suffering and say, why aren't you in joy? You know, what's your problem here? You know, that's not it. That's not it. From a human standpoint, our heart goes out to them. We feel compassion. We feel pain at their pain. We feel love for them. We do what we can. We serve them. But equally in our mind, we also see their perfection in God, whether they see it or not. And when we see their perfection, somehow that emanates out from us, that confidence, that faith. Even when they can't see their own perfection, we see their perfection. And how we've benefited when people have seen our own perfection, even when we can't see that, our own. But something gets conveyed in that. Something gets transmitted in that. And we may not even be able to acknowledge it in the moment, but down the road, somehow it has an influence on us. And somehow we begin to entertain the idea that that perfection could reside within us. And that helps us in our evolution. And that's perhaps the greatest gift that we can give anyone, is to see that light, to see that perfection, to see that purity within them, regardless of the mask that they have on. I had such a lovely experience of a woman that lived here in Vancouver. She had, for months, had been wanting to come to meditation service, but she had cancer. And seems like every time she got ready to come, she would just get more sick. Finally, she was in the hospital. And I said, well, for Pete's sakes, I'll come see you, you know. It's not a matter. It's just not a one-way street here. So I went to the hospital, and I was told by the family that they thought she didn't have much time, and indeed it was within a week, the time that she left the body. She was holding some things about her life that she felt very bad about. She had a son out of wedlock, and she felt that she had not given him the best life that he deserved, and she held a lot of sorrow and resentment about that towards herself. She also had eventually become married to a very good man, and she didn't always treat him very well, and some of it was around her illness, and she'd get very angry with him and took out a lot on him, and he didn't react to it, but she's feeling very badly about that. And so we worked on forgiveness. We worked on letting go of those things, and she did a beautiful job of letting go of all of those things. And then she just felt totally at peace. And she says, now I feel ready to go. And then it was within that week that she left this body. Now, it may seem strange to say, but from my perspective, that was a beautiful leaving. Now, there's another man that had been a devotee of Mother's years ago. And he had not continued to follow that path. He had a lot of fears about this world. He had a lot of paranoia about conspiracies and all this kind of thing. And when he left the body within a week of this other woman, he remained focused on his wife. He had wanted love from her and had never felt like he'd really gotten it from her. So he was hovering around her and looking for that. And so it took some work to get him to release himself from that. And eventually he did, and he released himself into the light. But he's very stubborn about hanging on to that. Whereas this other soul, who had done their work beforehand, she released herself right into the light as soon as she left this body. Very beautiful, wonderful leaving. So it makes a difference, the work that we do while we're here. And that's, you know, here's a woman in her last week of her life, and you think, well, life is up. No, life was not up. She had no hair. Her skin had turned green because of this medication she was taking. She's very weak, but her life was very important. And what she did until the last moment of her breath was very important. Something that God gave to me not too long ago is this idea of breathing our last breath. And when we think about it, and we come to that moment, and our life for this lifetime is up. And if we could, you know, normally what happens is, with that last breath, we want the next breath. We're desperate for the next breath. What does that do when we have our last breath? That just seals our fate that we have to come back to this body, a new body, in order to have the next breath. Well, that's not exactly what we want, necessarily. It's not our freedom. So if we can imagine in that last breath that we release that breath and our whole consciousness releases with it, and we release our consciousness into infinite consciousness, what a beautiful way, what a freeing way to leave this body. You can come back or not come back, but you see, then you have freedom. You have freedom. It's like one time when my brother was taking an Evelyn Wood speed reading course, and he was reading 3,000 words a minute. And I said, you know, but I don't like to read that fast all the time. Sometimes I really like to just enjoy a book. He says, you can always read slower. You know, somehow I had it fixed in my mind that I'd have to be reading 3,000 words a minute if I got up to that speed. He says, you can always read slower. It's funny how we, well, if we release ourselves into fully spiritual consciousness, that's more freedom, not less freedom. We can always choose to come back to a human body. But the point is, we have freedom. We're not compelled. And what a more beautiful way that is to live our life, to live in freedom.
So in that kind of a case, if there was still karma to run out, then is that done on the astral?
It can be done in the astral or in the causal. Sri Yukteswar says that all who attain Nirvikalpa Samadhi can come directly to this higher astral heaven where he's at and can be with him and help work out their final karma. But what's even better, of course, is to work out all of our karma. But it just depends on our karma. You know, it's how much credit card debt do we have? And how quickly can we pay it off? So, you know, it's not always possible. But I think that we should hold it in our mind that our goal is to pay off everything and to become totally free. And that's what our aim is, and that's what we're headed for. But whatever we leave with, then we take that with us, the benefit as well as whatever debit is left over. Yes, we take all the gains, whatever changes that we make. And when we leave behind a pattern that doesn't work well for us, a limiting pattern, we've left it truly behind. We don't need to face that again. A really good test for that is if you can think of a situation in your life and can you see God within that situation? Or a difficult person, can you see God within that person? And can you be more connected with the divine in that person than whatever emotional connection, either in the positive or in the negative from a human standpoint? And if you can be more aware of the divine within that, and the human seems like a small element of that, then you've released it. There's no hold for you. What you see there then is the divine. And the other is just a play. So it's a good test when we think about people, either our past or our present. And we go, oh, they just make me so mad. And we can't see the divine at all in that. Or they hurt me so badly. And we can't see any aspect. And that's a coming of age, spiritually. So it doesn't happen all in one fell swoop. Usually it's, you know, we take it in gradations. We take it a little bit at a time. But gradually we begin to uncover and we can see more and more of the divine. When you can see husband, wife, children, mother, father, all relations in your life, and you can see them all as evolving souls with some good things there, perhaps some negative patterns there, but you can see them clearly as an evolving soul. And it's not, they didn't do this for me. No, they're an evolving soul. And you can see them clearly that way without this heavy emotional attachment that they should be one way or the other. Then you've really come someplace, really arriving. And as we mentioned earlier, that's the very best thing that we can do for them. Even somebody that's done something terribly wrong, there's that revengeful aspect in this. But if you carefully analyze revenge, we want that other person to suffer a hurt in the same way that we did. Why? Because we really want them to get it. You know, when you do this to somebody, this is the pain that's created. So stop doing it. And really, that's what we want. We want them to realize that what they do matters and it has an effect, and we want them to behave differently. So our embedded within that idea of revenge, whether we realize it or not, is a desire for that other person to grow spiritually. So if we can become more overt about that, you know, rather than just holding the anger and wanting revenge and wanting that other person to hurt, we can say, well, I know my true goal here is I want them to become more highly realized. And I begin to send them light and see the light within them that must surely, you know, some it's hidden pretty darn good. And it's pretty hard to find in there. But if we can look at them with all faith and understanding and know that there is light within there. And it may be even beyond our reason. We may not be able to reason our way through it, but through faith, we know that there's light in there. You know, even within an Adolf Hitler or Joseph Stalin or Mao Zedong, there is light in there.
And don't we all get the chance with our past life review when we leave the body to not only see the actions that we did, but to feel the reverberation of that action?
Yes.
As it went out from us?
Yes.
So when the Bible says, vengeance is mine, saith the Lord, we don't ever have to concern ourselves with wanting someone else to feel badly because they're going to.
They are going to. That's right. That's right. And that is the revenge. And that revenge eventually leads to their own realization. Because that painful circumstances that may be produced in new births, you know, I think I've described to all of you a recollection that I had of my own previous birth where I had waged war. And then at another birth, I had been the victim of a war. And when that's firmly implanted in my head, the suffering that's created being a victim of the war, I could never wage war in the same way again without identifying with the victim. And that is the purpose of karma, is that it brings us around to the other side of the equation. If we are a victimizer, and then we experience ourselves as a victim, the victimizer in us could never again perpetrate that same kind of wickedness without identifying with the one who's receiving it. And that's why people who are highly evolved souls feel great pain at seeing suffering. Great pain. And you think, my God, why does this happen in this way? And your heart goes out to them in compassion. And you want a stop to the pain. You want a stop to the suffering. And that's natural for a highly realized soul to have that kind of compassion and that empathy with another soul who's going through suffering. At the same time, that's from the human side. And at the same time, if from the divine side, we can know and understand too that it's all God's play. Now, sometimes we may be more aware of the pain and the compassion that it generates inside of us. And at other times, we may be more aware of seeing it as the play of God and the play of light, and knowing that there's purpose behind it. But to hold both of them, that's the human and the divine, that's the personal and the impersonal. And the more that we can see those simultaneously, you know, Krishna, at one time with Arjuna, he has compassion for Arjuna, but he's also saying, arise, awake, rise up here, come up in your standards. Don't give in to this. And so at one time, he's deeply empathetic, and at the same time, he's trying to draw him up into the light. And so strength and compassion are not incompatible. They go very well one with the other. In fact, we must be strong in order to be compassionate. And to be truly compassionate, we must be strong. The two must go together. Distance is not the same as detachment. Detachment or dispassion means that there is a clarity in you about seeing the dynamics of things. If you have two children and they're arguing, and they're both small children, and you see them fighting over some toy or something, you can have understanding and know what that's like, to get invested in having something and wanting it as your own. You can also have dispassion in that you see that it's not that all that important, and you see them as working something out. If you have two dogs and you bring them together and they kind of snarl and bite at each other a couple of times, and then they work out their territory, and then they can coexist. One becomes top dog, the other something lesser. You just know that's the nature of what dogs do. It's part of their social pattern. So you can at one time empathize with there's this tension going on here between them, and also there's a greater understanding about this is matching a pattern for them. So it's at one time having this compassion, this understanding, this empathy for what people are going through. And also you see the larger picture. And that you can have both at the same time. Dispassion does not equal kind of dissociation, where you feel very distant and removed from the whole thing. Because in universal consciousness, you recognize your oneness with everything. Now, you couldn't have that and not be psychologically destroyed if you didn't have dispassion, because you would be overwhelmed by everything that's coming at you. So you have that witness personality that is watching everything that's happening, and at the same time, you feel your connection with the whole. Did that answer your question?
I think so.
Yeah. So if you feel very distant from things, then I would question, is this dispassion or am I cut off in some way? Which is not just dispassion. That's something that we do psychologically to distance ourselves from something that's painful. That's different than dispassion. That's actually attachment, Because the reason we feel the need to cut off is because we feel so much connection. We feel so much overwhelmed by that through attachment. Yeah. So that's a good thing. We should be at peace, and we should feel a sense of connection. And if we do that and we're not overly disturbed by something, that's all right. As I say, sometimes we'll be more aware of the impersonal aspect of God and we'll just feel the wholeness in everything. And other times we'll feel more the personal and we'll feel this deep compassion come over us, which can be very painful and very difficult when our heart goes out and we feel that compassion. But at the same time, there's this underlying knowingness about this universal nature of life. This wider perspective is also there. And we know the pain that we're experiencing in our heart is actually a part of that universal nature. And through that, we feel connected. From a human standpoint, when we feel connection, at that deep level and compassion at that deep level, oftentimes it throws us into a sense of aloneness and disconnection from the whole. And really, it's a self-absorption into an emotional state. And that's not true compassion, because we lose our connection with the whole. So we can feel pain, we can feel the difficulty, we can feel anger that something is happening. But the difference is that even in the midst of all of that is this larger perspective of the whole. And we know that our anger is a response, is a divine response to this event, whatever is going on. Or the pain that we're feeling is a divine response of compassion to what's going on. And so we don't feel disconnected and cut off. We feel really more connected with the whole. It's one of those times when I wish I had better words to describe it all. Okay, good. And it's something we grow into. We get it on a certain level, and then we have some experiences, and then we deepen that awareness and that understanding. Okay. O Heavenly Father, Divine Mother,
I feel the wonder and the beauty
of Thy glorious presence
in every part of my being.
My heart is bursting with my love for Thee.
I kneel in adoration at Thy feet.
And surrender myself to Thee.
I feel the power of Thy perfection.
Surging in every cell of my body.
My mind and my intelligence.
Are radiant with Thy healing light.
My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss.
Of my communion with Thee.
I and my Father are one.
Blessed Spirit, I am He. Within you all. Namaste. couple of announcements. Next time we meet, the third Friday, the Saturday after, we'll have potluck and kirtan out at Diane's house. Saturday evening, potluck will be, what, 4:35, 5:30?
Yeah, right. I'll be ready at 4.
Okay. Be ready at 4 anytime. Maybe plan on eating around 5 or 5:30. So if you'd like to be out there for that, that's always a lovely time. The first weekend of September will be my last time up here as I'm going into a year of silence. And till the next September. And the second Saturday of each month, we'll have silent satsang at Cloud Mountain Retreat Center, which is about a 2.5-hour drive south of Seattle. My understanding from Ruth also is that there's a train that stops not far away and that they are willing to come and pick people up, or arrangements can be made around that. So that is another alternative, and also that there's a bus stop not too far away. So those are all possibilities, and I would love to see you there. And the time will be spent in silence and meditation, and we'll have potluck lunch. So currently I've been thinking maybe meeting around 10 a.m., around noon, having potluck lunch, and then from 1 to 3, having more silent meditation, perhaps some kirtan and some singing. But other than that, silence on the grounds. Other meetings here and Maple Ridge will continue as before. And meetings in Seattle, of course, and other centers will also continue. And I think other special events, holidays, Mother's Mahasamadhi celebration will be the time of her leaving her body. January 31st will be our 10th year. And that's the one thing that I plan to attend in Seattle. And all are welcome down for that. And you'll get more information about that. The time gets closer.
Did you ever check and see the first week that you're there, you're going to speak? And you were going to check and see if devotees could come down and spend time during that week?
We have open house on that Saturday. They're considering whether they can take people. They have a retreat that weekend. So
the first weekend that you're there, or the second weekend?
It's the second, let's see. It'll be the second Saturday of September. I think that's around the 8th. 8th or 9th. 9th, okay.
Are you here on September 1st?
I am. Right. And I had somewhere in my mind that we might have open house, maybe potluck kind of thing on Saturday, either at noontime or in the evening. We can talk about that. I haven't talked about that with you, volunteering your house for open house on that first Saturday. Some informal time of getting together. More talking before I go into silence. Now you have to get it all out. It's very positive and very powerful to come together as a group. So I encourage you all to continue to meet together as groups. Helps us in our sadhana, our pathway to God. So to support one another, to love each other, to encourage each other. And there's a spiritual power that's built in that. So my strongest encouragement is to continue to come and meet together. always our spiritual path is ultimately a lonely one. It's between ourselves and God. It's so wonderful to have a spiritual family and derive the benefits of that too. You can all write to me, and once a month I'll write letters back. I'll ask people to make out a self-addressed stamped envelope, and that I can just slide a return letter and send it back to you.
Make sure they're American stamps.
Yeah. Yes. I think it's still the same. It was 52 cents, I think, American stamp to get to Canada. Larry Mahasia, when he asked people to write to him, he'd say, split the paper down in half, put your questions on the left side, and his responses would be on the right side. He'd send it back. You don't have to do that. I've felt that it's been my greatest privilege to serve you all in whatever way I've been able to. And of course, my love is for you is complete. I think when you get onto the spiritual path, it's not the most common thing in the world to find other people of like interests. And so to have this time together, to be able to love each other, support each other, encourage each other, it's a great thing. When I first came on this path and met Mother, I lived away oftentimes and nobody else that I knew of having like interests. So my appreciation for a spiritual family, for kindred spirits, is very high, having lived a long time without that. So thank you for your participation, for the love and the support that you've shown to me. It's meant a great, great deal to me. And my heart feels very full with gratitude. When I think of people who are attracted to this path, there's two things that always stand out to me. People who are intelligent and people who have big hearts. And I can't think of any combination I'd rather rub shoulders with. Did I forget any announcements? I think that's it.